You're listening to Broadcast APA's podcast series for our book, Green Community, co-published with the National Building Museum. In this series, we're speaking with some of the 23 contributors about the complexities of green community. I'm Timothy Minnell, the American Planning Association's senior editor of Planner's Press and the co-editor of our newest title, Green Community. We are here talking with Susan Piedmont-Palladino, who is the co-editor of the book and the curator of the related exhibition at the National Building Museum. Green Community is a collection of 17 essays around this very complicated and complex topic. It grows out of the exhibition, but also goes in other directions and speaks to different audiences. It's been a fascinating and unusual journey to pull this together, and I'm excited to have the opportunity to talk here with Susan about how we got here. Susan has been involved with this for how long now?
Well, involved with this in particular, meaning the exhibition, I think this probably goes back quite a few years. The exhibition itself will close this October, October 25th in 2009, and that will be the end of a full year that it's been open. And for me and my very small team over here, it took more than a year of research to get to that point. That sort of is my involvement directly in the Green Community exhibition, but I think I've probably been involved in writing and talking and educating various populations about green issues for quite a while. So this was a wonderful opportunity for me to put some of those ideas into practice.
Now, this is the third exhibition that the Building Museum has done on green topics. The first two were Big and Green, Towards Sustainable Architecture in the 21st Century, and The Green House, New Directions in Sustainable Architecture. Did either of those influence your development of the show?
Immensely. An interesting story behind that. Big and Green was the first of what has become a series, but wasn't intended to be a series. And I sort of cut my curatorial teeth on Big and Green. I got the chance to come in at the very last minute at that exhibition to help with the final writing of the exhibition text. And I put a lot of things aside to get the chance to do that because it's something that I believe in. And that was in, I think, 2003 that opened. And that was a huge, comprehensive look at, I guess, what you could call third-party architecture. That is, it looked at insurance companies, spec office buildings, sports stadia, big housing complexes, the full range of, like the title says, big stuff and big stuff that's green. They attempted in that exhibition to cover as much territory as possible because it was really looked at as a singular exhibition. It's got a wonderful catalog that's still in print, I think. And in some ways, that spawned a lot of interest in the public on learning more about it. And I think the public went to that exhibit thinking, well, this is fascinating, so this is what they're doing about this, and that third-person plural, what they're doing about it, in some way prompted the next exhibition, which was, well, what about me? I think a lot of our visitors felt that they wanted to make some changes to how they were living, and the idea for the greenhouse followed pretty quickly, that there was a real need and a desire to show residential developments, single-family houses, really focus on the things that the individual could do to change their environment. That was also immensely successful, and by then it became clear that the museum had elected institutionally to take a real advocacy position in terms of green and sustainable building. And so we decided that the next one really should focus on everything that's in between the buildings, and that was the idea behind Green Community. And that one in some ways poses some really interesting problems that the greenhouse didn't face and Big and Green didn't face.
In a certain sense, it seems to me that green community could almost be called even bigger and even greener. In that, you know, it's you've got a global focus in the show. We have a global focus in the book, and the kinds of topics that we take on, are all of the big ones: density, transportation, conservation, preservation, energy, health, politics. I mean, there's sort of no end to this topic once you get into it. I know that one of our first conversations, one of the things that you stressed was the need to take on the wicked questions, that all of these topics and all of the sort of green mentality that's out there has the easy answer, right? Oh, we'll just all recycle. Oh, we'll just all live lightly. Oh, we'll find good solutions. And the more you look into this, the more evasive those become. That all of these topics have just an irreducible complexity to them, and there are trade-offs and difficulties in all of them. And I imagine that was fairly central to your organization and conceptualizing of the show.
It was, and it's what, of course, made things really difficult. It is the biggest and the greenest, but in some odd ways, the bigness of the topic isn't as visible as, say, a big skyscraper is. It's easy to point to the newest building by Norman Foster or by Cohn Pedersen Fox, to name a few architects, and say, look at how this building is green, and it's big, and it's a skyscraper, and it takes up space. The bigness of our neighborhoods and our communities, or even getting someone to think about the concept of a watershed. Where does your water go? Where does it come from? These are really difficult, big concepts. And in that sense, we're trying to stuff the entire world into 4,000 square feet, which is, of course, not quite possible. And I think it also raises this question that for the design and engineering professions, who were probably the stars of the greenhouse and Big and Green, there are many other disciplines that are at play in green community, and it's sort of a wonderful demonstration of the larger community that involves planning, public policy, landscape architecture, urban design, architecture, and engineering. And so the architects, all the disciplines have to open up their doors and let all the other ones in. And so in that sense, the sponsors of, you know, our supporters for the exhibition, APA certainly, is our prime sponsor. But also the AIA was involved. But it's an interesting example of how the disciplines that need to help solve these problems also have to expand. And like you mentioned, issues of public health, which I'm not sure we all thought of at the start, but the more we looked into the things that we were talking about and that we wanted to exhibit, public health, mental health, food supply, all of these really profound questions come from the decisions we make about how we're living at that scale.
Mm. Well, it's true. The APA has not been involved in the earlier exhibitions, although we do have a number of shared programs with the National Building Museum. But this topic in particular speaks so centrally to planners and the range of topics that they get involved in and the range of allied professions that planners have to work with and have to be able to speak the language of. So in many ways, it's a really vital collaboration. You mentioned that you had only 4,000 square feet at the museum to work with, and we have only 192 pages in this book. And certainly it seems at times we could have gone on at 10 times the length. I think one of the big challenges from my perspective is how do you take these things and make them comprehensible, accessible, and brief, because, you know, we have a number of prominent contributors to this book who we'll talk about in a minute, all of whom can and have written entire books on these subjects. How do you go about boiling this down originally for the exhibition?
Well, there were two enormous challenges that came with the territory of the exhibition, and they both really had to do with selection and editing. We had many, many communities we would have liked to include. And even as the exhibition was opening, I was reading daily in various newspapers about one community after another that was doing something we would have liked to have exhibited or some piece of legislation we would like to have mentioned. And so that decision about not necessarily the greenest communities, but the ones that had a story we could actually tell within the confines of exhibition text and images. So we were really looking for a narrative that could help the public understand the nature of the problem, the action that was taken, and that the desired outcomes were in fact being borne out. And that was, we wanted to tell success stories. So it was in some ways heartbreaking to sort of X out various communities on our Excel spreadsheet that we had of our list, And then the other challenge was trying to condense these really vivid stories into chunks that people could read standing up. When you go to an exhibition, it's not the same as reading a book. It's a very different way of communicating. And so people are standing up, they're looking at images, people are talking around them, they're conversing. And to communicate the sort of full richness of a story, like the entire story of Portland's urban growth boundary and their commitment to mass transit and all of the different ways that that's changed the city, is a complex challenge. And it's a fun challenge. One of my favorite things is writing complex things for an interested general public. What the book lets us do, of course we had to make the same kind of fierce selection and editing, but what the book lets us do is dive deeper into the complexities of some of these issues. And it's for an audience that's ready for more and is hungry for more, and can patiently read one of these essays after another. Maybe they don't need to be read in order. And can look at some of the really, well, you said the wicked problems, the things that have multiple sides, that have consequences that are intended and unintended, and how do we deal with those things. So the exhibit in some ways laid out many of these issues that we think the book is going to explore in greater depth. So it's a nice sequel.
Let's talk a little bit about the organization of the book overall. It does come out of the exhibition, but it does have a logic of its own, a structure of its own, and it goes off in many directions that you weren't able to cover as fully in the exhibition. We're lucky enough to have an introduction by Sir Peter Hall, who gave the L'Enfant Lecture, sponsored by APA and the Building Museum, a few years ago. And one of the most interesting things to me about this piece, and a really sort of provocative way to set the table, is that he essentially says that there's nothing new about green community. There's nothing new about planning for sustainability, that good planning and good community development are timeless and have a very long pedigree, and that in a certain sense, while we're talking about very specific things now, certain energy sources or certain health problems or certain transportation modes, the ideals that underlie this entire enterprise are practically timeless.
They are. In some ways, there are new problems, but they're often problems that we made for ourselves with new technologies that we thought were solving older problems. And that introductory essay is really, it's a wonderful reminder that we used to plan and we used to design and build as if our lives depended on it. And because it was very much in our face, in a way, that our lives did depend on it. If you didn't have a successful way of living in the environment in the 16th or the 10th century, your town wasn't going to survive very long. And we've somehow managed to conceal that sort of present sense of how we have to relate to the environment because of our very powerful technologies that we've developed. And so history, in my view, history has a bigger basket of lessons to teach us about sustainable living than technology does. Technology offers a lot of solutions, but so many of just what would have been looked at as common sense strategies that we can learn from hundreds of years of how we've lived before, it's really our own attempts to solve those problems cleverly that have gotten us into this fix, which is kind of a strange way to put it, because it's our own innovation that also has made it possible to live better than we used to. I don't think we want to look at this as a nostalgic kind of rejection of modernity, but I think that we're at the point in terms of planning and design is that we can draw on everything that we've learned from history, and we can also draw on the technologies that have been available and are available now, and come to kind of a better balance of thinking about just because it's new, it's not always better, and that some of these ways of living actually do make us healthier, and they make a lot of sense, and in some ways are often more frugal. They're more frugal with money or resources, and those are also good lessons. But I think that opening essay is, gives you this quick history of our sort of history of human settlement. And I think particularly for the reader who doesn't have a background in it, that's a wonderful way to sort of lay out where we are now, where we've come from, that sets out, you know, some of the other issues that are going to be tackled in the book. One of the things that's a thread in the exhibition that carries through in many of the communities and the technologies is the idea of our own health, individual, you know, our mental health, our physical health, and also the concept of public health as a general public good. And in some ways, the development of public health as a discipline is somewhat coincident with early ideas about town planning and the beginning of planning and the idea that how we actually lay out our cities affects our own health. Modern epidemiology actually relates to cities. And so the idea of health and public health is a really good example of looking at our own, the progress in understanding the relationship between our environment and our health and gradually pushing policy changes to make those things better. The two essays in the book by Dr. Howie Frumkin and Dr. Esther Sternberg both contextualize those issues slightly different, but talk about the health consequences of some of the progress we've made being a little bit surprising. A lot of the changes of leaving the city, the sort of mess of the 19th century city and seeking the countryside, has resulted in some unintended consequences where now people are sprawled and that generated different problems. So the issue of bringing health really to the foreground of these topics, I think, is a really very powerful argument to make. It certainly figures in a large, you know, national conversation about health in general, and it's something that the exhibition couldn't really foreground in the way that the book has. So we're really happy to have those two essays in there.
Well, and the health question is certainly one that's of increasing interest to planners as well, and it makes the topics, you know, as you say, quite vivid. That people can even people who have sort of an abstract sense of what sustainability is, or even what planners do, can understand a public health crisis and can understand how, you know, our current systems imperil that. One thing that is interesting about the health thread and about many of the other pieces in the book is how they do embrace this idea of progress, this idea of moving forward. There's a sense that, you know, that these topics are timeless, but there's very little sort of backward looking. Oh, we have to get back to the garden, or we have to simply live in a simpler society. It's more a you know, relocalization and a redensification and an embrace of other ways to deal with, you know, the size of population we have now, or the complexity of our cities. There isn't a shrinking from these. It's an engagement, and I think that's what makes this so vital to planners, is that it's about grappling with problems that are already before us and are only getting worse.
That's what makes it actually such an optimistic book. Mm-hmm. It's rare to use that adjective when you're talking about climate change and environmental issues and all of these topics that can often seem just overwhelmingly depressing. But I think planning and design are ultimately optimistic professions, because we're engaging with actually envisioning and then trying to make a new and better world, make a new and better environment. And personally, working on the exhibition and meeting all of the people, from the local governmental officials to the people involved in the various government agencies, the leaders, the designers, the planners, I was just constantly inspired by the cleverness and the resourcefulness and the can-do kind of spirit of everyone that was involved in these projects. And the book has that same quality. These are major experts in their field. And like you said, they're looking ahead with conviction and commitment. And I hope it's going to be an inspiring book for people. It's a very encouraging way of looking at the problems that are in front of us. Instead of just reminding us that we're in trouble, it says it's really possible to sort of take a look at this from a variety of perspectives. And there are many, many ways to sort of make things better.
Well, I think that's right. And the conclusion of the book kind of speaks to that as well. We have a concluding piece from Congressman Earl Blumenauer from Oregon, who doesn't explicitly sum up the content of the book, but he sums up the mission of what is in front of planners, architects, students, activists, advocates of all sorts. You know, how do we make these things happen? You know, how do we translate, you know, our conceptual understandings and our ideas and our analysis into politics, into action? And I think that if you don't leave this book with a positive sense, then we've kind of failed. But I think it's fairly overwhelming that, you know, we have these problems. They're very vivid. They're interconnected. They're difficult. But everyone in this book is committed, and in these professions is committed to solving them.
Right, and you know, we think about who the possible readers for this are, and I would like to, you know, find this on a variety of bookshelves. I'd like to think that it's a collection that's accessible to an interested member of the general public who's not in the design or planning or public policy fields at all. I'd like to think that any student might use this as a reader in their course, whether it's a sort of cross-disciplinary course on sustainability, or whether they're architecture students who are trying to figure out how it is that architects can't solve this all by themselves. I'm an architect myself, and I teach architecture. And one of the things that's hard about teaching any of the individual design disciplines is getting them to understand that they have to learn how to converse with the other ones, and that all of us need to learn how to converse with the public and the policymakers and government, so that we can really start to look at solving these issues.
Well, it's been a pleasure conversing with you. Let's do it again sometime.
I think we probably will.
The book is Green Community, co-published by the American Planning Association and the National Building Museum. It is available for sale at apaplanningbooks.com and many other places. Thanks.
Thank you, Tim.